This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 192 was recorded on November 7th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, which happens to be my own favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. By popular request of our listeners, my feature interview guest this week is HedgeEye founder Keith McCullough. We'll discuss why Keith says accelerating inflation will be the key macro driver to pay attention to, and then we'll translate that view into some actionable trading strategies. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will discuss Ray Dalio's recent article, "The World Has Gone Mad and the System is Broken." There's a link to that article in your Research Roundup email. We've also got a post-game chart book where we'll review all of the S&P sectors, talk about which sectors are hot and which are not.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to this S&P 500. It's just not quitting. I mean, we almost tapped 3,100 today on the S&P. What's your thinking on the markets?
Well, clearly the melt-up is on, and it's no surprise at all to me. Needless to say, if this keeps going, the ratio call spread advocated by Tian Yang a couple weeks ago on this program is going to start paying off in spades. And I really think that's the way to play this market. Now, the ratio call spread is just one specific strategy. But, you know, I think what's happening here is there is a backdrop of really bad fundamentals and lots of reasons that if the old normal where economic fundamentals still drove the stock market was, you know, what was driving this, it would be time to go short, if anything. It's definitely not time to go short. It's time to recognize that a melt-up is on us. I think it's being driven by a couple of things. One is that it's clear that the Fed has the markets back. More easy money policy from the Fed means more money is available to finance corporate buybacks, companies buying back their own stock. That drives the market higher. And to be sure, I think the trade talks are playing into this. But I think probably the main thing that's going on here, Patrick, is what I call narrative failure. Everybody had convinced themselves, okay, Q4 of 19 is going to be just like Q4 of 18. It's going to be a repeat of that great big dramatic sell-off that starts in October and lasts through the end of the year. Oh boy, brace yourself. Well, a whole bunch of people were positioned for that. Some of them were short, they're covering. Some of them just scaled back on their long allocations. They're into fear of missing out mode and they're piling back in. So that's what I think is driving this exuberance that we're seeing. How much longer it lasts, I'm not sure. You know, Patrick, we got to get Charlie McElligott back on the program soon. He's been writing about some of these bullish scenarios recently. And again, it's not a story of economic fundamentals. It's about the reasons that positioning in the market, people, big institutional players being where they are, there's a lot of reasons that Charlie thinks there are setups to take the market even higher. So let's try to get Charlie back on the show as soon as we can.
So, Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which actually has been more or less recovering since last week. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Back above 98 on the December futures contract puts me back into my comfort zone that this is going to play out the way I expected. You remember what I've said in past weeks is, hey, the big pullback that we had was completely called for and should have been expected given the news flow. The Fed basically announced QE4 and then told us it wasn't really QE4, but in many ways it was. They're certainly conjuring money out of thin air to supply liquidity to the market. They're just doing it at the other end of the curve at the moment. So I think the squeeze is back on. That's played out. And I think that the dollar bearish factors have probably run their course. The dollar squeeze effect that Jeff Snyder has spoken so much about here on Macro Voices is now taking grip. And I think it's probably going to take us back up to new highs. I'll say, though, that my conviction about the new highs part of that is starting to weaken. There's quite a few smart people that I talk to that really think that October high was going to be the top for this cycle. I'm I'm not quite there yet, but I'm opening my mind to that possibility. If you want to hear that bearish argument that says the top is in, it's all downhill from here for the dollar, stay tuned. Keith McCullough is going to have exactly that argument in today's feature interview.
All right. So now, Eric, we discussed crude oil last week and the chart looked awful. And we thought crude oil, there was at least vulnerability for it to head down to the retest 50. But it seems to have reversed course Friday morning after last week's show. What happened?
Well, that's really the operative question. What did happen that caused so much of a bullish impulse to come into the crude oil market starting right after our last show on Friday morning? Now, the press is attributing this to China trade talks, and then also later in the week, we had Iran-sourced OPEC rumors saying, you know, maybe they'll extend the cuts even longer or do deeper cuts or whatever. Frankly, I don't buy it. We've heard those things before. The chart was really looking awful when we spoke last week. It didn't explain the amount of exuberance that we saw just slicing through all those moving averages, all of what should have been resistance levels, intermediate little resistance levels in the way up, just really, really strong tape action. So there was really strong tape action Friday and then Monday of this week, even as the trade talk news changed, which kind of took away that explanation. And even with that change, where the trade talk news had turned negative on Monday, it kept trading higher. Then on Tuesday, API inventory came out, and it seemed like that was sure to kill it because API suggested that there would be a build on crude oil inventory double analysts' expectations. It would still be a net drawdown after products, but still a really big crude oil build, double analyst expectations. Even in the wake of that bearish news, we still broke, you know, we came down on that news when it came out at 4:30 on Tuesday. But Wednesday morning, before we even got to the EIA data release, we broke through the 200-day moving average. That's a major, major resistance level to the upside before we even got the news. Then the news came out from EIA. It wasn't double the analyst expectations. It was four times analyst expectations. Huge, huge crude oil build. That resumes a string of 6 or 7 weeks of builds with only one down week in that stretch. Cushing, Oklahoma, really just blowing my mind, building 1.7 million barrels. Now, that's a big build in any week, but this is a week when the Keystone Pipeline went offline and we lost at least 1.5 million barrels to the fact that during this reporting period, there was 2.5 days of the Keystone Pipeline being offline. So that would be like 3 million barrels if you adjusted it for the Keystone outage. Gasoline drawing down 2.8 million barrels and distillates drawing down 0.6 million barrels. So crude oil, much, much bigger build, net build, much, much bigger than it was offset by drawdowns in finished products. Meanwhile, U.S. production maintaining that record level of 12.6 million barrels per day of domestic production. That is an all-time record set several weeks ago, which has been sustained for several weeks. Imports, 6.1 million barrels. Exports ticking down to 2.3 million barrels. Wow. You talk about really just incredibly bearish inventory news. Of course, there's an instantaneous drop in the market. Well, you know what? 5 minutes later, we had retraced right up to the same level that the market was trading at before that horribly bearish news came out. As if there's just a really persistent bid in this market that's bigger than the short-term trading events that normally drive the market day to day. So we had all of these things happening. Finally, on top of really, really bearish inventory numbers, we got news that OPEC, according to Bloomberg, was not really considering deeper cuts. In fact, most OPEC countries are not inclined to extend cuts. Then after that, we also got more news about the trade deal with China not looking so good after all. It was only after all that news came out that finally we started to see some serious downward price action. And even then, it only got down to its five-day moving average before it started to rebound again. After all of that horribly bearish news yesterday, by this morning, Patrick, we're back up retesting the 200-day moving average. Now, at the end of the day today, just before the close, the tape reversed. It was straight down. We took out the 200-day moving average, which is a key resistance level, to the downside. We closed nicely below that. And meanwhile, RBOB gasoline, which is oftentimes an early tell of where the crude oil market is headed, which was holding on to its 8-day moving average all day today, suddenly lost it just before the close, got almost down to the 13-day moving average by the time we hit the close. So as of the close, Patrick, we're rejecting and vigorously rejecting that key resistance level that seems to suggest, okay, it's over, we're headed down from here. But we've had that exact same signal for the last 4 days in a row. Rejecting the 200-day moving average to the downside, looks like it's all over, feels like it's all over, and then the next morning we're up to new highs again. So I won't be at all surprised if this continues. So what the heck is driving it? I think what's going on here is longer time horizon buyers are coming into this market. It's not the people that are trading crude oil day to day based on these little signals like what's this week's inventory number. It's people like HedgEye's institutional client base, which are hearing the same message that you're going to hear from Keith McCullough today, which is on a much longer trading horizon. Keith really thinks that we're out of what they call quad four. We'll explain that in the feature interview. Moving into a period of increasing inflation, Keith really thinks that we're coming into a secular move up in energy prices. So we'll save the bulk of that for the feature interview, but the gist of it is, it seems to me like there's suddenly a very strong bullish impulse. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I think it's longer time frame traders that are coming into this market.
Now, Eric, though, this afternoon you tweeted a thread about a trading opportunity for sophisticated investors who have the ability to put on or trade time spreads on the futures markets. What's going on? What did you see, and what's the ripe opportunity you're talking about?
Well, this is the best opportunity that I have seen in the market, Patrick, since the Abgig dislocation that we had. Specifically, I think a lot of our listeners know that primarily my own trading is time spreads, not the outright price of oil, but the difference in price from 1 month to the next. And this pipeline spill on the Keystone Pipeline directly affects those time spreads. Therefore, it's right up my alley. Now, exactly as I predicted on this show last week, everybody was saying, okay, the pipeline's going to be back on in 7 to 10 days because that's how long it took to fix it last time, back in November of 17, when it went offline. I don't think that's right, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But in any case, the time spreads, Patrick, have been moving dramatically higher ever since that event, and that's to be expected. It's exactly the same thing that we saw in the November 17 situation. The reason for that is that time spreads, especially near the front of the curve, reflect storage demand. And if you've got less oil coming into Cushing, Keystone Pipeline is upwards of 4 million barrels per week that it delivers into Cushing, 590,000 barrels per day. That goes offline. If it stays offline for a long time, it dramatically reduces the demand for storage because there's no oil that needs to be stored. It didn't come in from the pipeline. So the big question is how long it's going to be offline. The longer it stays offline, the more it puts upward price pressure on those time spreads. Now, in the November of 2017 spill, time spreads peaked 8 days after the event. So if you figured all things being equal, right now, about 8 days after the event, ought to be the ideal time to fade that move and short the most directly affected time spreads. Now, the thing is, all things are not equal. I think most of the market doesn't get it yet. They're assuming that the time to return the pipeline to full service is going to be the same as last time. I think it's going to be longer than last time. In any event, the most directly affected time spreads are already a very ripe short. It's February through July of 2020, WTI time spreads. So that trade is short CLG, Charlie Lima Golf 20, and long Charlie Lima November 20. Anything above 215 is a ripe short. It actually hit 241 today, which was a terrific entry price. Now, if it was the same circumstances as last time, I'd say, okay, this was the top. It can't go any higher. You know, you want to pile into this short because it's going straight down from here. I don't think that's the case. I think there's probably one more wave of the market realizing, hey, this is going to take longer to fix this thing than it took last time. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's one more wave that pushes those spreads, maybe even up above 50 cents a month, so that you're looking at 250 maybe, if we're really lucky on this 5-month spread. Full disclosure, I'm short several hundred contracts, so I do have skin in this game. But I think that there's plenty of room for these spreads to move higher on news, but there's no way it's going to last until that first contract expires in the middle of February. So I think it's a terrific trading opportunity. Unfortunately, it only works for traders who are sophisticated enough to trade future spreads, which is not for everybody.
All right, so let's move on to gold, because gold had a pretty significant breakdown this week. I mean, it looked like just earlier last week that it was going to attempt to break out, and suddenly we're breaking to multi-month lows, at least on an intraday basis. We printed below the October low. What's your thinking on gold?
Well, as a listener on Twitter said after last week's show, he said, okay, we finally got the major bearish signal. Townsend capitulated and started scaling into a long position. That means the market's about to crash. And as much as it sort of sounded like an insult, I really enjoyed that tweet. I was sort of toasting that guy, saying, yep, exactly what I was thinking when I started scaling in. I said, if there's anything that'll make this market finally go down, it's me buying. And sure enough, that started to happen. I think we still have more to go to the downside. I still think $1,400 is probably coming. But you know what? I'm going to continue to scale in. Each time we get a day like today, after we're finished recording here, I may go and buy some more gold. Because although we are bouncing off of that October low, you know, I think we're going lower, but I've been wrong about that in the past, so I'm going to continue scaling in. I definitely want to save some dry powder, though, because I think it's quite likely that we'll get down to low 1400s, if not below 1400.
All right. Let's move on to that 10-year Treasury yield, which we had a pretty significant pop in yields today. I mean, we came a stone's throw on an intraday basis toward 2%. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, you know, clearly a more substantial backup in rates is now upon us. And it's tempting, I suppose, to say, okay, the trend has reversed. You know, it's time to short the bond market. I don't think so. I'm glad that I already closed my long position, but I'm definitely not going to go short here. If you look at how far we moved so far, so fast, as yields collapsed over the last year, we're long overdue for a significant pullback. And if you look at how far we moved, just a 38 or a 50% Fib retracement takes you way the heck above 2% in yields. So I think that long term, the secular trend toward lower yields is probably still intact, but I'm not sure that it's time to be long here. I think it's maybe time to get out of the way and wait for a better entry opportunity.
So this week's featured interview guest is HedgEye founder Keith McCullough. Now, why did we invite Keith back onto the show this week, Eric?
Well, two questions embedded there. First, why Keith? And second, why right now? First answer, why Keith? Keith is one of the most popular guests that we've ever had on the show. We frequently get emails from listeners requesting that we get him back on the program. We can also always count on the HedgEye guys for a really solid slide deck. We've got a terrific slide deck for you this week, so be sure to download that, guys. We're going to make extensive references to it throughout this interview. The second part of the question, why this week? Frankly, you know, we let all of our guests sell whatever they're selling at the end of the interview. I try to give everybody a chance to tell our listeners what product or service their company has on offer. HedgEye, as a matter of very firm policy, only really goes deep discount on their subscription products once a year. And that's Thanksgiving Cyber Monday special, which they're running right now. So my policy has always been, as much as we love Keith, if we're going to have Keith on the show, I know he's going to be promoting HedgEye products. I want to do that at a time when we can get our listeners the very best price of the entire year. And thanks to your work, Patrick, although it's already time for HedgEye to have their prices at the lowest they ever put them all year, we got an even deeper discount, which is just for our Macro Voices listeners. The slide deck that you're going to download has all of those links to the discount codes that you need in order to get that very best pricing. So the reason we waited for now, even though we had quite a few requests to get Keith on the show, is I like to have Keith on when he's got his stuff on sale. And this episode of Macro Voices is made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Now, I did a full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen, the host of this excellent podcast, back on September 7th of 2019. The download link is in your Research Roundup email next to Niels' picture. In that interview, we discussed a number of key issues about the value of having a rules-based investment strategy in your portfolio. In our conversation, Neil shared some insights that may surprise you, especially when it comes to how trend-following strategies don't really operate the way some market commentators suggest they do. For more information, including a free book about trend following and the accredited investor slide deck from my interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Keith McCullough is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Keith McCullough, founder of HedgEye Risk Management and one of the most popular guests that we've had on the show. Keith, it's great to have you back. Now, our regular listeners already know that the guys at HedgEye can be counted on for some of the best slide decks in the business. So listeners, I strongly encourage you to download the slide deck which accompanies today's interview. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Keith's picture on the homepage. Keith, the first dozen slides or so in the slide deck talk about the process that you use at HedgEye, and I can't emphasize strongly enough the importance of process and having a process. But since we've covered this whole process before, I'm going to refer our listeners to several of the previous interviews that we've done with Keith. If you haven't heard those interviews, I do encourage you to learn all about the process that HedgEye Risk Management uses. It's one of the best in the business. Just type in Keith's name on the search box at macrovoices.com. Go back to his first interview where we went into this in detail. Keith, I want to skip ahead and just do a quick review of your process, at least the essential process concepts from slides 4 and 5, before we move on to the rest of the deck, because I'm really looking forward to going deep on your recommendations for this quarter. Slide 4, you talk about the second derivative and slope and why that's so important. Please give us a refresher course starting on page 4.
Sure, and thanks, Eric, for the kind compliments. Process, if I didn't have one, I probably shouldn't be on Macro Voices, so I appreciate that. We focus on the rate of change, or the second derivative move, on both growth, GDP growth, and headline inflation. The reason why we do that is, of course, because it backtests as being the most causal factors for your asset allocation at the macro level, which would fully include sectors, long and short, and your factor exposure. So on slide 4, we're just showing you what the prevailing consensus wisdom is, which is not that people focus or anchor on valuation as a starting point. This time is different. Economic gobbledygook theory, et cetera. But again, I'm just trying to figure out where the next and most probable dot is, if you will, for growth and inflation within the confines of that sine curve. So that's on slide 4. And then on slide 5, we wrap that into what is effectively a 2x2 model. So you have two things. You have growth and you have inflation, and both are being measured and mapped on a trending basis, which means 3 months or more, all the economic data. We run that 30 data points per month, which would give you 90 times per quarter to change your view based on a data-dependent view. So there's no politics to it, of course. And again, there's no valuation bend to it. Quad 1, 2, 3, and 4 is what you see there. Quad 1 and 2 are pro-growth. So that's when everything is great, rainbows and puppy dogs from a growth perspective. Quad 2 is, of course, when you have both growth and inflation accelerating at the same time, and even the Federal Reserve figures it out, and they have a central tendency to raise interest rates. That's why in Quad 2, Treasury bonds, for example, across the curve are a terrible place to be, and so is gold. Conversely, Quad 4 is the best place to be for long-term Treasury bonds and for gold, because you have both the rate of change of growth and inflation slowing. At the same time, when the Fed figures that out, they try to cut interest rates, devalue the dollar, and drive you. Essentially, they'd like to have you back in quad 1 or 2, but they have a central tendency to take you to quad 3, which is, you could just name that stagflation, where you have the rate of change of inflation accelerating as real growth declines, which is where I think the U.S. economy is right now.
Okay, so you're characterizing the current condition of the economy into one of these four quads at any moment in time. And again, listeners, if these concepts are new to you, I highly encourage you to listen to Keith's first interview, where we really go into details about this process. Let's skip ahead now, though, to slide 13, which is where we get into the current condition. You're saying we're coming out of quad four and maybe into quad two or quad three. Tell us what's going on here. Why is that the case, and what does that mean in terms of asset allocation?
Well, the biggest thing that it means is that what already happened for the last year, Eric, is in the rearview mirror. Now, quad four, as I pointed out, loves treasuries across the curve. It loves anything that looks like a treasury, which would include utilities, REITs, bond proxies, gold, silver, housing. It loves quad four. So again, we started making the quad four call last year in September the 27th of 2018. You'd make that call when the U.S. economic cycle is officially at the peak. Then you slow from the peak, and then you just continue to slow. So the end of quad four was comparing against the 2018 U.S. economic cycle peak, because we had quad four in Q3 of 2019. So that's that was the end of quad four. The market's been trying to price that in. Ostensibly, the next move is into quad two or quad three, is what we're saying. It's the data stacking up much more so in line with quad three. So again, quad three is stagflation, whereas quad two is up, up, and away. And I do think it's quite an interesting setup, because historically there's no precedent to have the president of the United States, you know, trumping up and tweeting up the stock market, you know, and talking about deals and people getting excited about what could be a quad two, but there's no data that supports a quad two, which would fully include buying a lot of soybeans. So that's where we're at on that. On slide 14, you can see how our quads are, which is, again, United States, our most probable outcome, deal or no deal. And again, if the deal, post-deal data were to change that, we'll change our mind. I'm not in the business of, you know, saying what the data should do. I'm telling you what the data actually is doing. So if you look at the world's economy, what you see here is the top 20 countries by GDP. The USA is at the bottom, and it goes, our outlook is quad three, and then quad four, with quad four again coming back in the middle of 2020 ahead of the US election, which would be a pretty nasty setup for the stock market if you were to take it from the all-time, you know, high, which is of course at the time of us having this conversation. So I think it's a pretty interesting setup, suffice to say. I don't really care what quad it is. I'm long the things that work in both quad two and quad three, which again, the data is tracking in quad three, both in China and in the US, which matter more than anything else. So what I'm going to be long is inflation. So that is what's similar in quad two and quad three, is that you have, no matter what, you have inflation going up for the first time in a year instead of down. So there's a lot of different things that we can do in terms of asset allocation on that. The biggest pivot when you look at it in terms of fixed income is to get long pips. If you look at it in terms of equities, the biggest pivot from being short in quad four to long in quad three is energy stocks. Energy, of course, is hated and underowned on a historical measure, I might add. And then on the short side, what you do at the U.S. equity sector style level is you get out of what was a great long during quad four, which is a bond proxy sector called consumer staples, and you short that. So consumer staples in quad three is a good example, really, Eric, of stagflation, because you have input costs rising. Stagflation is when you have inflation rising, both labor in this case and the input costs. You know, we're bullish on commodities in quad three, just to reiterate that. But you don't have any pricing power. So you got these companies that are older than dirt in some cases that have not really had pricing power for a long time, and all of a sudden their costs start going up, so their margins compress and the stocks go down. So that's one simple way, I think, to read through how quad three can play into a sector and a company.
Now, I want to address specifically, you said inflation accelerating is one of the key trends you've got on slide 13, and you just said a moment ago, that's what you want to be long, is things that do well when inflation is accelerating. Some people would say, okay, number one rule of macro is gold is your inflation hedge. So if you think inflation's coming, it has to mean that you're, you know, stepping up your allocation to gold. I'm not sure that you guys see it that way. Please give us the perspective on how gold plays into this story.
That's a real important question. It still takes me. I mean, every year is a new year trying to learn something that I don't know. And what I didn't know when I was a younger man was that what you just said is not true, if indeed the economy is in quad two. Okay. So quad two, you have inflation rising, but you have real growth rising. Gold hates that because real yields are rising. So gold, what it really likes is when real yields, as you know, are falling. Now, that can happen with inflation or without it. That's why gold works, you know, in quad four and quad three. So again, when you look at it in quad three, that's when you have stagflation and real yields are still falling. So I think, you know, when you think about gold as an inflation hedge, it's especially a good inflation hedge when you have a stagflating economy and the lack of alternatives to invest in. So that's, again, you can go back historically and see that there have been many times, notwithstanding one of the most epic quad threes that has ever happened in the U.S. economy. And again, these quads aren't subject to debate. They're just economic facts. It just characterizes what the economy was doing. And if you go back to 2011, when gold hit an all-time high, I mean, you didn't have quad four, you had quad three. And that's when, you know, you had plenty of things that people would believe, oh, wow, look, you know, the Bernanke's devaluing the dollar to a 40-year low. I got inflation ripping to new highs. That's when the CRB index, which is a broad base of commodities, 19 different commodities, was hitting new all-time highs. So, of course, he had inflation, and of course, he wasn't admitting it. But you, of course, also had gold work in that environment, too.
Moving on to slide 15, we're getting into China. Now, it seems like almost everybody, at least the mainstream media, our friends on the cable networks, are talking about how, hey, as soon as a deal with China, a trade deal comes through with China, that's just the game changer. Everything is unicorns and roses from there. Is that the right way to think about this? And I know that you have the utmost respect and esteem for our friends on the cable networks, but do you see it maybe a little bit differently?
Yeah, I mean, that's a joke. I mean, it's like, you know, you wouldn't be on Macro Voices if you're a macro tourist like that. I mean, that's what macro tourism is. I mean, to define it, it's when people jump from headline to headline because they don't know what else to do, as opposed to jumping from time series to time series. And that's what a good rate of change person does, is that they don't care what anybody on CNBC says or otherwise. Yeah, some of these other ones, I'm surprised people even watch. But the reality is that what we're trying to watch is what the data is doing within the lens of the process. So on slide 15, you know, you can take two different views of China, i.e. it's bottomed, which is on the left side of that chart, or on the right side of that chart, if you use a three-year comp or a three-year base effect, or simplify that, a three-year look back on what actually happened in the world, you'd say, oh, no, it's going to continue to slow at a faster rate as we're signing phase one of the deal and doing the curtains and everything and celebrating the all-time highs in the stock market. And it's going to slow and slow and slow for the next three quarters post the deal. So again, the reason why we're using a three-year look back on that chart, Eric, which you know, but just to explain it, I mean, what it's showing is secondary industries in China. So that's heavy construction, partly empty cities, all the stuff that China stimulated back in 2016, and for that matter, which they stimulated in 2009. These are the 64 million empty apartments and the most concrete used in human history. This is what they do, and this is what they did, but they're not doing it right now. So that's the point. You know, the biggest stimulus in the history of China, and I think everybody on this call, because they're macro aware, knows that there's a long history in China. But if you look at slide, you know, you took that from 0% growth in 2015, late 2015, 2016, when Xi was about to get elected for life, and he ripped it to 14% growth, which equated to 50% of Chinese GDP growth. And now, as the base effects of that stimulus are continue to heighten, incoming data continues to slow at a faster pace. And even the Chinese who are making up their numbers are admitting that. That's why they continue to cut their numbers and are actually willing to try to do some kind of a deal because they think that they need it. But it's not going to change it. This is a secular picture. And I can't use that word more often. You know, and I'm not talking about secular growers, which everybody on the planet Earth that's long tech continues to talk about. But I'm talking about secular slower. You know, China is a secular slower. And that's the point here, is that we're well past their peak. They've stimulated multiple times to have the world believe that that wasn't a secular peak. And from here, I mean, I actually think that China, if the data continues to look as bad as it does on their own made up numbers, it looks like Japan in the 1990s. And it's going to be, you're going to have a hell of a lot more tweets and bean deals to eliminate the economic gravity associated with that.
Now, if we go 5 years back, even, there were lots of people predicting, okay, China's, you know, just at this unrealistic artificial level, they're going to start going into decline. It's going to send a deflationary shock around the world. half of that came true. I mean, they really are in significant decline, as your charts are showing here on slide 16. But we haven't seen a contagion to where China blows up the global economy. Is there still a risk of that? Was that just a crazy idea in the first place? How do we think now about what could happen in China and what it's going to mean to the rest of the world?
Well, that's a real important question. And at every stage and at every point in the next cycle, again, these are cyclical factors that run into new realities. So, the new reality here is that the dollar is at a 20-year high. And that the Chinese, if you just look at that actually on the next couple slides, slide 16 in particular reminds you that, this isn't like 2016, by the way. You weren't at a 20-year high on the trade-weighted dollar index, and the Chinese themselves weren't all that willing to devalue the currency. So again, they're short of dollars is the other point. So again, if you think about that in terms of slide 17, we just remind you of why they're the world's largest borrower of U.S. dollar-denominated debt. Well, unlike in prior cycles when China was running a big surplus, current account surplus, now they have a developing current account deficit. And the only way they can fund their deficit is in dollars. So if the Fed doesn't get off the schneid and cut interest rates more aggressively, I think the way you ask the question is important, because to me, the answer is, how do things blow up? It's if the Fed doesn't get the dollar down, then you're not going to be able to get away from these realities that are A, new, and B, making the transmission mechanism for Chinese liquidity, quote unquote, to not be impaired. On the right side of slide 17, you can see that it literally is impaired. You've basically cut the reserve requirement ratio or interest rates in China six times since they started slowing again in 2018, and it hasn't done anything for Chinese demand. In fact, it's actually, we're on the lows in terms of even shadow financing demand for loans fully loaded. So that's the problem, is if the Fed, and that's really the final point on and I'm not, I'm not the guy that tries to get famous writing a book on how the world blows up on what day of what month, Eric. I mean, I think that's a little ridiculous. If you get that right, then cool. But that's not what I do. What I would just submit is on slide 18, if the market's right on what the Fed should be doing, which is devaluing the dollar, and that's what I'm showing you here, in order for Beijing to bail us out, the Fed has to capitulate and cut rates more aggressively. If the Fed doesn't do that, then this thing, there's going to be a nonlinear pattern to the downside that most people aren't prepared for. So again, this has actually never happened before. For those of you that follow the Fed's dot plot, which is accurate about 30% of the time at best, again, it's showing you the Fed's forecast versus what Fed fund futures are implying. And it's at its widest deviation or divergence, however you want to characterize it, going all the way back to when the dot plot was invented, by the Federal Reserve, or at least published. So again, what this is saying is that if you think that the China bean deal and that the Fed are going to be right post the deal, that everything's going to be back to rainbows and puppy dogs, well, that's completely offsides with what the market's expecting in terms of interest rate cuts. And more importantly, like I said, what the market needs and global economy needs, which is a weakening of the U.S. dollar, which you can only have if the Fed indeed goes incrementally more dovish from here.
Now, I've been following your daily updates on the dollar, and obviously, as you know, and as our listeners know, the dollar hit a all-time high on some indices. On the dollar index, it's not an all-time high, but it's still certainly a cycle high back on October 1st. But ever since these announcements from the Fed, it's been selling off. We've reached the point where at least your short-term support levels, the hedge eye bottom of the trading range, has kicked in. Does that mean that we're going to see a reversal here, or is this going to be maybe a dead cat bounce before we break through those levels and see a new trend emerge?
Yeah, I think the peak, like our call on the dollar was crystal clear. I mean, I couldn't make it more clear. When we're in quad four, when both the global and U.S. economy are in quad four, the dollar goes up. That's it, period. And that was our call going back to when China, EM, and Europe, for that matter, all started slowing at the beginning of 2018. It was pretty easy to see that the dollar liked that, in lieu of other people's currencies and problems. And then the dollar really liked the fact that the Fed had to go from hawkish to dovish at the end of 2018 and early 2019. So, that's it. If you can't show me, which, by the way, so I do think it's a six-month call, short call, or get out of the dollar long position and think of the other side of it, which is, we can get into that too, which is, I think, just buy commodities. That's the easiest way to go right to the asset allocation vein. But again, until we get back into the market discounting that we're going to re-enter quad four, i.e. when both growth and inflation are slowing at the same time, which we have happening again in the middle of next year, then I think that the dollar, you know, starts to break down. I mean, that's basically what you're pointing out on the hedge eye risk range, is that when the risk range starts to develop a series of lower highs and lower lows, the trend eventually breaks to the downside. And that's what I'm not willing to believe, that just market signal that I've embedded. You know, when I look at a market, I look at, where are my quads? Where's the most probable outcome economically, A, and B, what's the market signal? Is it agreeing or disagreeing with that? The market signal is agreeing with what my quads see. And again, in quad three, the dollar is not a long, it's a short.
Okay, so the October 1st top, you think that has a good chance of being the top, at least for a while?
Yeah, for at least 6 months, because again, it would fit right on the screws when quad four in Q3 of 2019 ended. So again, I'm using these words specifically because mathematically that's just a fact. I mean, you had, you know, quad four in Q3, you know, ends obviously at the end of September, and lo and behold, the damn dollar just stopped going up right at that point in early October.
Got it. Let's come back to slide 19 in the deck, where you're saying that equities are a 2019 fear of missing out story. What's going on here?
Thanks for spelling it out, too. I mean, I am, in as much as some people are compensated to be addicted to the FOMO, I think people need to understand the link. They are gainfully employed to buy stocks. You know, like FOMO to me is like, I have my own personal FOMO on not using the FOMO, because it's just like such a great narrative that only Wall Street could be addicted to. But just remember that the story this year is that you have to be willing to believe. Believe me, in the words of your favorite president. You got to believe. You just got to believe that earnings have bottomed, even though nobody on Wall Street a year ago said that the earnings have topped, other than us and maybe some others. Maybe you said it too. But, you know, that you have to believe, even though you couldn't believe that you're going to slow from the cycle peak of earnings to now negative year over year earnings, that you just got to buy stocks. You know, that you just got to buy. Even though historically, when this has happened and we're at the widest divergence, and again, I pay a lot of attention to divergences that have a central tendency to mean revert or come back to where they've always been. You have, you know, the difference between the level of the S&P 500 and the earnings revisions to the downside hasn't been this wide going all the way back to, and I'm showing you, you know, what the forward PE is implied right now on slide 19 relative to where we started the year, going all the way back to 2000 to 2001, which is not a good reference point to buy stocks. You know, that's just not smart. I mean, so I think that even again, if you go back to October of 07, obviously the stock market, what could possibly go wrong? It went up to almost every day and then finally stopped going up in early November. So it is an interesting thing. On slide 20, though, like you can see this. I mean, the global GDP trend is obviously down into to the bottom right. That's why bond yields globally did what they did this year. And at the same time, on the right side, which is this like Wally World chart, I think it's crazy. I mean, I guess being a macro person there, you're always going to see crazy, but you don't want to be crazy. Like, you don't want to be the person buying this. The next 12 months of earnings expected in the S&P versus the Russell, like, look at that. You could drive a truck through that. That's the widest it's ever been. So the way I read that chart is that the Russell earnings don't hope for any bean deal or any big China resolution, because it's more local. And the S&P 500, you're just waiting for companies to tell you the truth, which, by the way, and systematically has started to happen. So you're seeing an earnings season now. Earnings are down about 2 to 3% year over year, which is the worst it's been. And it's a broadening. So you're seeing it broaden to -6% year over year in tech. Consumer discretionary, which is the other big sector people are long, have negative earnings and falling. You have to believe that that's a bottom that you never called slowing to begin with, and then an acceleration, which is, I think that's like the stuff of madness personally, but that's how I look at it. I think that it could only be summarized with the acronym FOMO. I mean, how could you not just chase year-end benchmarks, because that's what you get paid to do? So it's interesting, because that's obviously always been Wall Street's problem, is that they'll take living in the fear of God of that index return, and they will be willing to believe pretty much anything.
Keith, I couldn't possibly agree with you more. And if I look ahead to slide 21, you can see CapEx is already on the decline. These slides are all painting a really, really strong picture of, hey, guys, you know, the party's ending. It's not time to be piling into stocks expecting the next big move up. But I want to play devil's advocate for a minute because I've become pretty cynical about this market. What if I were to say, look, we're living in a kind of screwed up reality of central bank control now that we didn't used to have. And so if I look at all this, what I see is bad economic data. That means, as you've said, the Fed is going to need to continue cutting. That's going to enable more easy money financing for corporate buybacks. That's going to allow the S&P to melt up even more, as crazy as it might seem to you and me. Therefore, maybe fear of missing out is not the right rationale, but there's certainly, I don't want to be jumping into the short side of this market right here. I'm afraid that we could see a melt up just based on easy money driving more corporate buybacks.
Yeah, we already, I mean, to characterize what's happening today or throughout October, early November as a non-melt up, I think would be a mischaracterization. We are seeing a melt up. I mean, there's a melt up across the board and people chasing, like I said, you're willing to pay a higher and higher multiple for less and less earnings. And that is, I think you're in it. I mean, I think that if you also kind of take a step back, I always look at, you know, what the market's done going backwards, because there have been multiple periods of FOMO where, you know, within 5 to 6 weeks, you know, people are on their knees kind of crawling on the linoleum floor, begging for more cowbell. And by the way, buying every one of those non-stressful dips, you know, was the thing to do. And so I think I agree with you on there as well. Because again, at the end of April, at the end of July, right now, I mean, if you get sucked in at the wrong spot, you can have a 6 to 8% drawdown in a very short period of time. And then who really is willing to buy, you know, at that level? So for me, I resolve this by basically buying what I like anyway at the low end of the range. I mean, the current part of the melt up, by the way, has been driven by a sector that I'm long and most people won't touch with an 80,000 foot pole, which is energy. So, you know, I think it's more about being long. And that's essentially the genesis of the hedge act process. You know, relax. Stop being so stressed about CNBC marketing of the Dow bro and spies. You know, you can be smarter than that. For the last year, you could have owned something that outperformed SPYs by almost 2,000 basis points in REITs and utilities. So again, it's we're trying to find the thing that we can own within the thing. So again, the sectors of the S&P 500 that we want to be long, and not live in daily stress of trying to beat the S&P 500's benchmark gain or loss, for that matter. Don't forget that the S&P lost 20% of its value over a 3-month period at this time last year. Not that anybody remembers, but it certainly, you'd be reminded of that if it happened to your own capital.
Now, you guys are obviously data junkies. I think that we agree that what's going on right now is there are already clear macroeconomic signs that say stock prices should be lower. That's not happening because we are seeing a melt up for the reasons that I've described, having to do with easy money enabling buybacks and so forth. Is there some indicator? Is there some magic hedge eye chart that says, okay, here's the signal to watch for that tells you that gravity is about to set in and reality is going to take over instead of this melt up on easy money mentality that we've been in? Or is that unpredictable?
I mean, unless it's different this time, which, you know, as we alluded to at the beginning of the conversation, that's not what I do. You know, you get somebody who's got a much bigger brain than me to come up with all these different theories on how it's different this time. I'm a student of cycles, and never in the history of cycles have earnings deteriorated from peak cycle to slowing to negative, then more and more negative on a year-over-year basis, and you've not seen a commensurate decline and multiple compression in stocks and or a widening of credit spreads. So that's it. We're literally right at the end of the thing. I mean, most credit investors will say, okay, that's fine. Like, look at credit. Credit, the all-time tights were in early 18 when the global economic cycle peaked. USA continued to chug along, so there are plenty of parts of credit that did fine over the course of the next year. But the parts of credit that were linked to China and China demand falling, they widened. And again, so credit has been deteriorating underneath the hood in as much as the S&P 500 has been. Don't forget the Russell 2000 is still down 8-9% from where it peaked in 2018. And plenty of sectors have been horrendous places to be relative to the alternatives. So again, I just think that it's actually still happening with the boogeyman being the thing that, you know, macro tourists stare at, which is the headline Dow. in points, you know, saying, oh, it's all clear. I mean, look at the amount of new highs in either the S&P or the Dow, for that matter, relative to the Dow and the S&P 500 making new all-time highs on their own. It's at a very wide divergence, which is also pretty consistent with, by the way, a market top and people capitulating, saying, oh, my God, it just is never going to go down again. And then it could go down in a ball of flames. Again, that's not my call, but I'm certainly, if it does go down in a ball of flames, I'm not going to lose money like the people that don't think that it won't will.
Let's come back to slide 22, where you get into labor share of income and corporate margins. Talk us through what's going on here.
Yeah, so that's it's another, it's probably less of a rant of a way to just show in a picture what I just said. I mean, and another reason why, to be clear, that we're super bullish on growth and all the stocks you should be long in quads one and two is when you have GDP growth growing faster than wage growth. So that was, you know, Hedgeye's call from mid-2016 until we said basically the peak of the cycle of Q3 of 2018. That was a long, for me, that's a long ride. But it's also the ride that you're on. GDP growth was greater than wage growth. Now we have GDP growth falling and falling below wage growth. So the whole point on wage growth is that it's the latest of late cycle indicators. So 100% of the time, again, this is not different this time, Eric. 100% of the time, wages continue to accelerate into a recession and perpetuate a profit recession and a broader recession. So basically, we're right at that point now. And what I'm trying to say, you know, with the quads is that by Q2 of 2020, your highest recessionary risk on this basis will have, you know, will be staring you in the face. Because again, there's no catalyst to get people's wages lower. There's a reason why GM has had a successful strike, you know, the people did against the company. And the last time they had one like this was in 2007, again, at the cycle peak. That's when the people have more leverage because corporate profits are coming off their peak. So again, you know, we're going to see margin pressure. I think it's a foregone conclusion. I think Wall Street is offsides on seeing a continuation of that. So if you look on slide 23, I'm just showing you the rate of change of year-over-year sales and earnings for the S&P 500. And what, you know, the street's basically saying is that, okay, I get it. You know, this whole China thing is, you can blame everything on China. You got to blame it all on China. Nothing on the cycle, God forbid, or tax reform perpetuating the peak of the cycle in conjunction with the Chinese stimulus. Those two things back to back are like the most epic stimulus you could think of in historical terms. And the street's looking for a reacceleration of earnings in the first half of next year. Of course, as companies continue to guide down on the fourth quarter, so you're going to have basically two quarters going on three in a row of negative year-over-year earnings. And that's, again, it's pretty simple to understand. If the Fed doesn't get that dollar down and demand continues to slow, labor continues to rise against peak comps, then you will see a further and I think a faster degradation in earnings. We think that earnings could be easily down 5 to 8% year over year within the next, you know, either this quarter or the next quarter. And that's, you know, that if it's like 2001, that's the beginning of a very nasty period for U.S. stocks. And 100% of people that I worked with, never mind the people that were spewing old wall research to me as a young analyst in 2001, 100% of them had that wrong. Because they said, oh, you know, we're growth investors. We're all long tech and comms and everything else. And then lo and behold, you know, S&P earnings were actually down in the teens year over year for multiple quarters in a row. And that's when the real proverbial poop hits the fan.
Moving on to slide 24, we're coming to my former occupation, which was the software industry. What's going on here?
Well, it's peaked. I mean, I think that to me is like the call within the call is that you have a bubble.
Well, it peaked when I got out of it in 98. Obviously, that was the secular catalyst. But
you should have come back to it, Eric. I mean, it's like, you know, macro voices as a service. You know, I mean, you could have gotten multiple on that, right? Like, this is crazy. It's not crazy what happened. It's actually predictable. I mean, so we have tax reform, and we have the largest sales force in America right now, or at least the biggest and you know, best paid is that it sells software as a service. You know that. And that's where all the market caps have been created. And there's a bubble that was being, you know, was brewing. All this great technology, all these apps, everything that people love. Now we have massive sales forces. Salesforce.com is almost metaphorically the big building it's built for that in San Francisco. To me, is kind of like Encana in at the peak of the energy market in Calgary, Alberta. But again, you know, I digress. You basically had a catalyst at the end of what was a developing bubble, which was tax reform. So tax reform, for anyone who doesn't know, you can depreciate 100% CapEx against your net income. So if you're like me or Eric or anybody who has their own company, you're looking for things that you can deduct, right? What can I invest in my business that can make, you know, my business better? And software becoming a capital expenditure as opposed to an operating expenditure became, you know, basically what you see there. The peak of software's growth rate was basically at this time last year. So growing like double digit growth year over year, we're showing you software CapEx on a year over year basis. And again, the whole point is that as you compare against those peak growth rates, you're going to slow anyway. So that's the point. Like at this point, Amazon Web Services, which is basically one of the largest cloud companies in the world, is slowed 260 basis points year over year, which is a lot, but that's in line with the base effect or the comp going up about the same. So to me, it's just math. Your software might be the greatest thing since the last time I was told that the internet was not called the cloud. And to your point, back in 1998, that was a great ride to be on. But again, you know, we've renamed a lot of different things, but we've given them similar multiples. We talk a lot about the TAM, 15 to 20 times revenue, and it's all good and fine until the companies tell you that their growth rates are slowing with rising labor forces and cost structures. So to me, that's why we're short software. And it's been working, really. I mean, it peaked, obviously, back in July. So even though the market's making, like the SPYs are making all-time highs and people have to buy stocks, you know, if they bought the wrong software stock, they got their ass handed to them. And that's the problem. I mean, I see more short selling opportunities in these secular growers that are meeting a cyclical slowdown, i.e. a secular grower, which Wall Street affectionately came up with that, is just a company that's never seen a cycle. So I think there are loads of companies like that, not the least of which are the ones that are most famous and kind and dear to their hearts, like Uber.
Keith, moving on to slide 25, I know you guys at HedgeEye very much embrace the long-short equity strategy, and I happen to know that just because I just released a video on how to run the long-short equity strategy, which is the original hedge fund strategy, in a private investment account. And I actually mentioned HedgeEye in that video because you guys are the only ones I know of that are available to retail investors who provide both long and short equity recommendations. Talk us through the concept of what a long-short pairs trade is, and why is it that long energy, short software right now is a particular favorite that you're describing here on page 25?
Yeah, that's perfect. And by the way, most people aren't perfect at making short sales. So again, when you think about a long short strategy, you have to have not just somebody who has short ideas, but somebody who has accurate short ideas. So the number one place you should go is thinking about the rates of change. So again, you can think about that in terms of a company, or you can think about that in terms of sectors. Now, sectors, like which we're showing here on slide 25, I think it's a great pair trade just using CapEx as ends. So again, CapEx from a top-down perspective is slowing. Now, software CapEx is slowing at a faster rate against bubble comparisons, whereas energy CapEx has negative comparisons, easy comparisons, because energy has been blowing up for some time now, as it should during quad four. So now you got energy CapEx can be down 5 to 10% year over year, whereas software CapEx can slow, in the prior slide we show, from up 11, 12% year over year to something in the low single digits. I mean, it already did back in 2015. You can see that. So again, now when you look at that pair, because again, it's based on the same premise, you're starting with the cycle, and you're like, okay, what's going to accelerate and what's going to decelerate? Then you look at the index weights. Now, as a percentage of the S&P 500, energy is on its lows. Everybody knows that. That's why you can't get a diversified portfolio manager, mutual fund manager to buy energy, because they haven't had to. So again, they all own tech. They all own consumer discretionary, and most of them really owned software. Okay, so software, as you can see, is coming off its highest level ever as a percentage of the index, and energy is coming off its lowest level. So all I really need to have this work, Eric, is energy to go up in terms of price. So if I'm right on my inflation accelerating theme and natural gas and oil continue to make a series of higher lows and break out to the upside, then energy just has to be 5, 6, 7% of the index, and it has to come out of somewhere. And I think it's going to come out of the place that has the most obvious slowing, which is software.
And again, just to explain this concept for any newer listeners who are not familiar with hedge fund strategies, the whole idea here is you don't know what's going to happen to the S&P. Is it going to go up 30% or is it going to go down 30%? What you want to have is a balanced portfolio of both long and short positions so that you make money if the market goes up and you still make money if the market goes down, because in that scenario, your shorts outperform your longs. That is the subject of both what I think you teach, Keith, on an ongoing basis on your macro show on the HedgEye Network, and it's also the subject of a video that we just released on the Macro Voices YouTube channel. It's a free video, so be sure to check that out. Let's go ahead and move on to your final slide, which is what you guys are doing. Keith, we actually waited until now to get you on the program. We've had several listener requests to get you back on, but we happen to know that your marketing guys wait till Cyber Monday, right after Thanksgiving, for your very best pricing of the year, and we wanted to wait to have you on when you could offer our Macro Voices listeners the very, very best deal. It's already this time of year is when HedgEye offers their products at the lowest available prices. Patrick has negotiated with Matt and Dan on your side to get an additional discount for Macro Voices listeners only. So give us the rundown between the HedgEye Q, Elite Pass, and Platinum All Access Pass products. What are these things? Who are they for? And give us the story.
Yeah, sure. They're for everyone. What we're learning is that as we open up more of what we do in terms of the entirety of the process, and again, there's a singularity to our process. So there are a lot of components to a good risk management process. And what we're doing here is you're seeing it's tiered in terms of access to those components of what we do in terms of price. What we've learned is that people prefer to get a bucket. So if the smallest bucket, of course, is the one where you get our quarterly macro themes, which is the HedgEye IQ product. So again, you're going to know every 3 months what our themes are and where the big changes are coming. And then we give you ETF Pro Plus, which is basically long and shorts across the board, as Eric and I have been talking back and forth. And again, this is global macro long shorts. So again, it includes a bunch of commodity ETFs on the long and the short side, depending on where we are in a different quarter. The Elite Pass is just broadens that out. So you get the early look, the macro show, the daily ranges. That's for more of a power user, real-time alerts, obviously. And then the big one, which is the one that's actually, I think, most popular, even though it's the highest price, is the Platinum All Access Pass, which basically gives you every single thing that we publish to the non-institutional community, but it also is our large components of what we provide to our institutional clients who pay a lot more than that price, I can assure you. So that's the deal, and we like to do it. Like you said, you figure it out when we do it, because we only do it once a year.
Well, and the deal for Macro Voices listeners is actually even better than the deal that you only do once a year for everybody else. I'm going to take personal credit for a part of that story. I know you guys didn't used to offer the Macro Select product as part of the packages, and I've been telling Dan Holland for a couple of years now, don't underestimate the high-end retail people. We have a lot of guests on Macro Voices who assume that they're boutique institutional research. They think, well, we don't sell it to retail because they would never understand it. There's a few people that do understand what you guys do in your Macro Select, which I believe you used to only do that for your institutional clients. And so I'll take credit for having encouraged you to expand your offerings. Now, I wanted to start by giving you your chance to plug your product, but even for the benefit of our listeners who are not interested in buying anything, I want to give you a little tip, guys, because there's a lot of free stuff here that's not obvious. In your Research Roundup email, there's a download link for the slide deck that we've just talked through. There's a separate download link for what looks like it's just a one-page sales brochure for these different products. What's not obvious is the whole list of products that are in blue. Those are links to free issues of each one of these different products. So even the high-end Platinum All Access Pass, which includes Macro Select, which is institutional-level macro research, and Demography Unplugged, which is Neil Howe's podcast. A lot of our longtime listeners know that Neil Howe is probably my favorite intellectual alive in terms of his work on fourth turnings and so forth. Absolutely. absolutely brilliant guy. There's free examples of all this stuff, and it's not obvious. It looks like it's just a one-page sales brochure. It's actually a list of links to free stuff. So I strongly encourage all of our listeners, whether you're interested in buying anything or not, to take advantage of the free samples that are included through the links on that sales brochure, which is a download in your Research Roundup email. If you do want to buy anything from HedgeEye, be sure to use these links that are on page 26 of the slide deck, because they do give you additional discounts that are even lower than the going prices that other people are paying during this Cyber Monday promotion. So the $899.95 for the Elite Pass, I think it's $999.95 for the general public. And I think the Platinum All Access is $2,000 for the general public. It's $1,750 for Macro Voices listeners. So be sure to use the right links in order to get the appropriate discount. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Keith. It inspired me to put together a chart book to talk about the different sectors in the S&P 500, and want to later in this post game get to that chart book. But many of our listeners that don't download the chart book need the link. Can you share that with our listeners?
Sure thing, Patrick. And again, these links are all in the chart book if you did the download in your Research Roundup email. And actually, the links themselves are in your Research Roundup email. But for some reason, we always get people asking us for them. So again, the links are hedgeye.com/macrovoices PAAP for the Platinum All Access Pass product, hedgeye.com/macrovoices EP. Echo Papa for the Elite Pass product, and hedgeye.com/macrovoices HIQ, that's Hotel India Quebec, for the Hedge IQ product. All of those links will give you substantially lower prices than even the very lowest HedgeEye price that they have for their Cyber Monday special, and actually by a considerable margin. So be sure to use those links if you want to get in on HedgeEye's products. But Patrick, before we go on, I just want to mention, for people who are not interested in buying anything from HedgeEye, don't miss the free research giveaway. This is the first time they've done this with us. In your Research Roundup email, there's a download link for what is ostensibly a sales brochure trying to get you to buy one of those products. There are sample issues of all of their different research products. Now, a few of them, which are like daily, you know, price levels, obviously are not relevant if it's not the same day. But most of the content in there is very interesting macro research, which is just as relevant today as the day that it was written. So I strongly encourage all of our listeners to take advantage of the free research from HedgeEye, regardless of whether you care about signing up for the paid subscription service.
Eric, I wanted to move on. There was that great article from Ray Dalio, and both of us had a chance to read it. It was called "The World Has Gone Mad and the System is Broken." And both of us agreed that it was a worthwhile conversation to have with our listeners, right?
Well, the conclusion here is inescapable, Patrick. Obviously, Ray Dalio must be a Macro Voices junkie. He's been listening to our best ideas, and he's now publishing them as his own. No, actually, I don't really believe that, folks. If anything, what I would say is the best ideas that we've been talking about for years on Macro Voices, I am so envious of Ray Dalio's gift for taking very, very complex macro subjects that usually only very, very smart people are able to understand. and distilling them down into simple language that your grandmother could understand. So, folks, I cannot recommend this article strongly enough, even if you already understand all of this stuff. If you're looking for something to give to the people in your life that don't understand all of this investment stuff that you do and are just trying to understand what's wrong with the world and why the financial system is so screwed up, this is just such beautiful, plain English writing. I'm so envious of Ray's writing style. I wish I had his ability to articulate myself as concisely as he does.
So, Eric, I want to first tackle the one segment he has in there where he talks about the pricing of financial assets. So he goes on to say that prices of financial assets have gone way up and the future expected returns have gone way down while the economic growth and inflation remain sluggish. And goes on to say that more companies than any time since the dot-com bubble don't have to make profits or even have a clear path to making profits to sell their stock because they can instead sell their dreams to those investors who are flush with money and borrowing power. It goes on to say that there is now so much money waiting to buy these dreams that in some cases, venture capital investors are pushing money onto startups that don't want more money because they already have more than enough. And so I had to ask you, I mean, you sold your software company in 1999, but does it really feel like the dot-com bubble?
Oh, it does to me, but I have to qualify it and say, at the time, I was a software entrepreneur. I didn't understand any of this macro stuff. And what I do remember is all of the other CEOs that I knew were kind of looking at each other in the first class lounge at United Airlines saying, you know, I'm getting offers to sell my company for more than I know it's worth, and I don't really get it, like what's going on with these finance guys. And none of us got it. We didn't understand. But we knew that the valuations were just too good to be true. And this was 98, before it even really got to the total blow-off top part of it. And, you know, the reason that I sold my company, I wasn't ready to retire, but I just looked at the valuations they were paying for little companies like mine. And I knew that it was some kind of bubble. And I didn't understand any of the factors that were driving it because I didn't know about macro stuff. But I knew it was crazy. This feels just as crazy. But as Ray describes, it's a totally different set of circumstances that are driving it this time. At that time, everybody knew the internet was going to be a really huge thing, and it caused all kinds of just crazy, irrational exuberance, and people just wanted to get in on it, even if they didn't understand exactly what it was. This is a completely different scenario. The problem now is that there's too much money. We had this big credit crisis, the whole great financial crisis. It was resolved by central banks coming to the rescue, conjuring money out of thin air and using it to buy financial assets. And the result is that the professional money management industry now has too much money to invest. And that means that they pay more for assets than they're really worth. And that means that the yield or return on those assets is low and expected to stay low. And we've gotten into this greater fool theory where, you know, you're buying things that are clearly, you know, negative yielding junk bonds in Europe. How do you buy that? How can you possibly justify making that purchase? Because somebody else is going to pay even more for it when you turn it around and sell it to them. So it's greater fool theory that has been institutionalized by central banks. And the thing is, as much as it's tempting to say, this is crazy, it's nuts, it can't last, which is the big mistake that I've made since 2008, is I kept convincing myself, this can't go on any longer. It's too crazy. Surely it's not sustainable. Well, what Ray Dalio explains very, very succinctly in this article, Patrick, is, yeah, it can go on. They've got a printing press, and it does lead to other problems, but the idea of them being able to continue to conjure money out of thin air and pump it into the financial system, there's nothing stopping them from continuing to do that.
Now, you were talking about conjuring money out of thin air. I want to move on to the next segment where he talks about this in a little bit more detail. So he goes on to say, at the same time, large government deficits exist and most likely will increase. And it's going to require huge amounts more of debt to be sold by the governments that naturally cannot be absorbed by the markets without driving interest rates higher substantially. And this is at a time when interest rate rise would be devastating for the markets and the economies because the world is so leveraged. And he goes on to say, so where will the money come from to buy these bonds and fund these deficits? He says they will come from the central banks, which will buy that debt that is produced with freshly printed money. The whole dynamic in which sound finance is now being thrown out the window and will continue to probably accelerate, which is especially the case in the reserve currency countries such as the US, Europe, and Japan. And it goes on to the scenario that we're, I guess, old turning Japanese, where essentially we run big deficits and the central bank just buys all that debt, right?
Well, and Patrick, I think the really key point to understand here, and again, it's the one I've been missing, is a lot of people are saying, okay, this can't go on forever. We've got to see some kind of blow-off top in this 35-plus-year bond bull market. Surely we're going to get into a secular bear market in bonds. And what Ray is saying is no, it doesn't have to go that way. If we had natural market forces, supply and demand, give and take, economic normal, the old normal, maybe that would be true. But in the new normal, where the central bank is ready to come riding in, the choice that they've got is they can let the natural forces in the market take interest rates much higher and bankrupt governments and pension systems and cause massive, massive social disturbances across the world. Or they can conjure even more money out of thin air and keep propping the system up until something else breaks. And what he describes is, as much as it seems crazy, the path of least pain, you know, the one that's most likely to be chosen is the one of central banks continuing to keep interest rates suppressed. And we're not likely to see bond rates go screaming higher. We're likely to see central banks continue to keep them lower in order to keep this game of musical chairs, keep the music running a bit longer. Someday that music's going to stop, Patrick, and Ray goes on to explain what will eventually stop it.
Right. And so he continues on to talk about these unfunded liabilities and how this is going to move forward. He touches on demographics, saying there's going to be fewer earners that are going to be obviously taxed to support a larger population of baby boomers. And there simply isn't going to be enough money to fund all these obligations. And so how will that gap be bridged? And so he says there's one of three things that can happen. Either A, you're going to cut the actual benefits, all these unfunded liabilities, or two, you're going to raise taxes, or three, you're going to print money. And he gets to the point that the easiest path is printing the money because it's hidden away in creating a wealth transfer. And at the same time, it makes asset prices rise. So there's going to be the least resistance by choosing the money printing path. And because there's no limitations to the amount of money that can be printed, the big risk is that it threatens the viability of the three major world reserve currencies as a viable store of wealth.
And I think that point is really important to clarify, Patrick, because some people think, okay, so that means the dollar index, the DXY, has to crash at some point. No, it doesn't, because remember, the dollar index is relative to those other major currencies. It just measures the relative strength of the dollar compared to other fiat currencies. The real point that Ray is making is the major fiat currencies of the world are going to be devalued in terms of purchasing power. How do you translate that to actionable trading strategy? It's gold. Or if you believe the cryptocurrency argument, there's an argument for crypto there. I don't happen to agree with it, but I'll acknowledge that it makes sense to some people.
So the final segment here that I want to talk about is that he touches on how that capitalism is broken. And it says that because the trickle-down process of having money at the top trickle down to workers and others by improving their earnings and creditworthiness is not working, the system of making capitalism work well for most people is broken. This set of circumstances is unsustainable and certainly can no longer be pushed as it has been pushed since 2008. And this is why he believes that the world is approaching a big paradigm shift. So, you know, Ray is really getting to this stage of thinking that there's some sort of big shift coming in, and it's coming, and we're closer to it than we've ever been before.
I think he's exactly right. And what I would love to ask Ray about, because he doesn't mention it in this article, if we could somehow get him onto Macro Voices. We've been inviting him for years, and unfortunately his staff have declined. I'd like to tie this into Neil Howe's work on generational cycles and turnings, because this is the classic fourth turning setup, where major institutions in society get torn down and replaced with new ones. And it's really important for old guys like me to listen to what younger generations are saying. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but you know, they're the young generation is coming of age. They're going to be the ones making the decisions going forward. They have different values than I was brought up with. And frankly, I think of Howard Beale and Network. They're mad as hell, and they're not going to take any more of this. Well, what are they mad about? They're mad about the fact that there is horrific wealth inequality, and it's getting worse. And they're right about that. Unfortunately, I think most of them are misdiagnosing the cause. They think the cause of that horrible inequality, which is horrible, is capitalism. And I disagree. I think capitalism is the cure. If we could go back to capitalism, something that we haven't practiced in decades, that I think would be the best way to cure this horrible wealth inequality. But they don't see it that way. And I think that if you look at where most of the sentiment exists in younger generations, it's some combination of much more socialist, both policies of government generally and particularly monetary policy. And I think modern monetary theory is going to be used to justify a whole lot of much larger government, you know, everything from universal basic income to free college tuition to healthcare for everyone. We're going socialism as the solution to a problem that socialism can only exacerbate. And it's so sad to me that we've done such a poor job with education that so many of these younger people who are justifiably mad as hell and don't want to take it anymore think that capitalism is the problem that needs to be solved. And I think they're exactly right that there's a problem. Unfortunately, I think they're misdiagnosing it.
That's right. Anyway, so let's move on, because I put together a chart book. I was inspired by Keith during the interview. He was talking about the energy sector and that he viewed that a lot of the bond proxy sectors could really start to roll over, like consumer staples. And I thought it was a great opportunity for us to kind of take a tour through the S&P sectors to see what's been working and what's rebounding and how it's all kind of unfolding. And so let's get to the chart book, Eric.
Okay, listeners, you'll find the download link. It says Postgame Chartbook in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Keith McCullough's picture. Patrick, let's dive right in. Page two, you've got the S&P chart. Let's start there.
Really, the S&P chart, you were talking about it in the market wrap. Really, what I wanted to just have a reference point on this chart to compare to all of the other charts. I mean, we've basically broken to a fresh new high over the last several weeks, and the market continues to tread higher as we approach 3,100. And what I really wanted on page three was just to show the breakdown of the S&P 500 by weightings. And you can identify that technology, financials, and healthcare, the three sectors, basically make up over 50% of the index. And so really wanted to just see what's working and what isn't in that entire space. So it's on page four where we have the technology sector, and this is using the XLK technology ETF. And we can really see that the leadership continues to be the tech space. I mean, obviously it's stocks like Apple that continue to rip higher. The semiconductor space is doing so very well. And there is no doubt that the technology space is the leadership. What's particularly interesting though, Eric, is that the financials on page five, which have really been dogging it for almost the entire summer, for 6 months, they were just range bound, really have broken out. And this is truly where some of the leadership is. In fact, I would argue that the financials in the last week or two have been one of the strongest sectors by far, and see some real acceleration in some of those money center banks.
Now, these are ETFs that only trade during stock market trading hours, Patrick. But as a technician, what do you make of all of those numerous daily gaps? The conventional wisdom, of course, in technical analysis is all those gaps need to be filled, and that would suggest that a pullback is coming.
Yeah, I don't know if I would personally overread too much into each of those gaps, but I would certainly think that after such an extended move, we're going to be due for some sort of a throwback in the markets. I think the exercise that I want to go through here is more about trying to grasp what sectors are working and which ones aren't. And that's really where I want to get to page six and talk about, on pages 6 and 7, consumer discretionary and consumer staples, because the two sectors simply have not been bid. I mean, we are talking complete and total range-bound markets within consumer discretionary and consumer staples. They simply have stopped participating in the last 2-3 months. This is an area that is not getting any money. And we've seen on a lot of those Coca-Colas of the world and McDonald's of the world, all have rolled over. Amazon hasn't participated. I mean, really, this space has just not been touched. But going on to page 8, this is where I wanted to talk about healthcare. And what's interesting is healthcare, which has been very similarly to the financials, a dead space for the last 6 months, really has broken out. And we're finally seeing some of these healthcare sectors really gaining some traction. It'll be interesting to see whether healthcare continues to be a bit of a leadership sector moving forward. Clearly, the financials and technology are really the big leadership group. But healthcare is definitely participating.
Now, how do you reconcile that leadership that you're seeing on page 4 in XLK in the technology space with Keith's call that software is the short here and that the new place to be long as we get into this sector rotation ought to be energy?
Well, I'm not opposed to that view that he has, but there's certainly no technical evidence that technology is letting up here. And so, I mean, usually, you know, when you look at a space such as consumer staples on page 7, which he is short of or believes it's rolling over, this is typically the type of price action you would see before a rollover, which is the momentum stalls, the price can't break higher highs, distribution starts becoming more prevalent. These kind of characteristics of the kind of rollover we're seeing in consumer staples, there's zero sign of that in technology. But when you're doing a long short, the way Keith is suggesting, you don't really need the technology space to stop going up. You just need the energy sector to be outperforming it. And so maybe it will work, but it may happen just that the energy space is just going to have more traction, right? So anyway, Eric, I wanted to move on. On page 9, we have the industrial ETF, and the industrials have participated. That's definitely moving, and same with materials. And that's, I find that interesting that the materials are finally moving, kind of plays into that reflation narrative, and maybe these sectors will finally get a little bit of momentum. But really on page 11, where the energy ETF is, and this is where Keith really believed that there's room for the sector to rebound. But the energy sector has truly been the dog. I mean, it has been the serial underperformer, and it is finally getting some traction here. I mean, from a very oversold state, there is definitely lots of room for this sector to go. The question is, will we see that follow through? I mean, I don't know whether you have an opinion on it, but I generally feel that in order for the energy sector to really have a solid tailwind, you want to see oil prices properly breaking out. And will we see, let's say, oil getting north of 60 or something like that? That's what would, I think, be necessary for this energy sector to truly get some proper tailwind.
Well, just a few weeks ago, Patrick, even a couple of weeks ago, I would have said, sorry, I just don't see it, because what I'm seeing looks to me like this market is waiting to get through a little bit of China trade exuberance before it eventually dumps and goes lower. What we're seeing, though, especially in the last couple of weeks, as I described in the market wrap, is it feels like on one hand, you've got the usual short time horizon oil traders that are doing their thing, reacting to inventory numbers and so forth. But overlaying that, there seems to be this persistent bid. It seems like longer time frame traders are coming into this market and they're buying it as a much longer time horizon macro trade. And they're not worrying about what this inventory number or that OPEC rumor happened to be. They're just looking at it for the reasons Keith described in today's interview, which is over the next quarter to 6 months, it looks like there's a lot of macro reasons to expect outperformance of the sector. So it feels to me like there are traders in the market that seem to to jibe with that explanation. Now, I suppose those traders could be somebody else who has some completely other non-public news that I don't know about. But somebody is bidding up this market in a way that just doesn't feel like the market has felt. And I'm only referring to the last couple of weeks.
Right. So the final thing that I wanted to just touch on pages 12 and 13, I have the utilities and the real estate ETFs. And both of them look like they've put in legitimate tops, and both of them look like they've begun a correction. And I would say of all the sectors, they are the ones that you can label as true bond proxies and sensitive to interest rates. And so when you're looking at those charts on the 30-year treasury bonds or the 10-year treasury bonds, you can really see some correlations developing here. And the question that is in my mind is that if we have seen short-term tops in bonds and we're going to see interest rates, let's say, head back to 2 or 2.25 on the 10-year yield, will we continue to see the sectors of utilities and real estate have been outperforming the other sectors throughout much of the first part of the year? Are we now seeing this big sector rotation that is now going to see them materially underperform? It's a real risk and something that's on my radar.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, this chart, I think just visually, you can see there's been a pretty darn consistent channel here. And we've broken that channel to the downside. We've got a couple, several candles, full candles outside of the channel below it. So it looks to me like there's definitely been a change of direction here. Patrick, we're going to need to leave it there in the interest of time. Today's episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen, published on September 7th, 2019. The link is in your research roundup email. And listeners, be sure to sign up to get your own research roundup email every week. It's free, and it provides you with links to all of the best content we can find on the internet, including free research, downloads associated with our program, and so forth. This week, it also contains those discount codes for the HedgeEye offers. Patrick, tell them what else they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Keith McCullough's presentation and the charts we discussed on the sectors in the post game. There's also an interesting article from Jim Bianco talking about the repo market has been drugged into submission, as well as that link to that Ray Dalio article we discussed about the world has gone mad and the system is broken. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.